Have you had a mosquito bite yet this year? Have you removed a tick from some part of your body? Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. We'll certainly talk about mosquitoes and ticks and other insects as well with our guest, PJ Leash, who has degrees in biological sciences and entomology at the UW-Madison. He's with Extension and the university itself and manages the UW-Madison's Insect Diagnostic Lab. So we're going to talk with him about insects today and certainly looking forward to hearing what you have to say, what questions, what experiences. Maybe you've got a photo of an insect that you want to have identified or an unusual insect. Love to hear from you. You can send the photos to the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our Facebook page. Or you can call us with a question at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. PJ, welcome back. Great to have you with us again.
Great to be here today, Larry.
Lots of stories in the news about mosquitoes, especially because of the Zika virus.
Definitely, yeah. And the Zika virus itself, I mean, it can be a very serious situation because of the birth defects, microcephaly, and things like that. The good news for us in Wisconsin, overall, I feel Zika is really going to be a pretty minor story for us here. The reason for that is that there are two mosquitoes associated with transmitting that virus. Aedes aegypti, the yellow fever mosquito, and Aedes albopictus, the Asian tiger mosquito. Neither of those species are native to the state. They're native to elsewhere. We can find them in some of the southern states, but we just don't have them here. And if those mosquitoes that can transmit the virus aren't here, transmission should be pretty minimal.
And hopefully it'll stay that way.
Hopefully. I know some of my colleagues, Susan Paskowitz and her research team, they are going to be doing some surveying in the state to see if maybe these mosquitoes have shown up over time. But at this point, we haven't found them here, so I think Zika risk for us is pretty minimal.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And, you know, with all the visiting and now summertime, people back and forth, there's the possibility it could come in on something.
Right. I think there certainly will be some Zika cases in the state, but it's more likely going to be folks traveling. And I'm going to be really interested to see what goes on with the Summer Olympics, being down in a place like Brazil, where we know Zika is a big problem at the moment. But folks travel to even the southern states or some of the Caribbean islands, they could potentially pick up Zika virus and bring it back to Wisconsin.
John in Glendale has a question for you, so let's go there. John, thanks for calling. Hi.
Oh, hi, Larry. I want to ask your guest, just dealing with mosquitoes. I heard talk in the media recently about eradicating the species entirely. I was just wondering what his opinion is on that.
All right, that's a decent question. I mean, it's come up in the conversation.
Yeah, so it's a rather interesting topic. And if you look at some of the discussion, folks aren't talking about wiping out mosquitoes as a whole, because mosquitoes do provide some services, their food to other creatures and things like that. The discussion has been more about eradicating very select species, one or two species. And if we look at these species like Aedes aegypti and Aedes albopictus that transmit Zika, they're also associated with some very important diseases like dengue fever, chikungunya. There are different mosquitoes associated with things like malaria. And on a worldwide basis, malaria is one of
malaria
the biggest killers
awful.
On the planet. Yeah. And so even some of the expert entomologists and ecologists have essentially said it, if you weigh all the benefits and risks, it may, in theory, if you could do it and pull it off, it may be worth it to wipe out just these select few species because they cause so much harm to humans.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine how they do it.
It's very difficult. I don't think it's really feasible with the technology that we have, so it certainly would be tricky to pull off.
You can join in, too, with your questions or comments as we visit with PJ Leash about the world of insects, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And Chris in Wisconsin Dells suggests an organic pesticide, wonders what you think of it. It's called Cedarside. Bug control for dogs, humans, and yards. Do you know anything about it?
I've heard of the product Cedarcide, and I've actually heard radio ads and ads in other forms of media. And this is an essential oil product. And there is some research data indicating that essential oils can be toxic to certain insects, and they might have repellent properties in some cases. But overall, in terms of their effectiveness, it seems to be either pretty minimal or very short living, whereas some of the more conventional products can last a lot longer and work a lot better in certain cases.
Mm. Well, let's turn for a second to ticks. I was out in the woods with my daughter, and we were doing a little turkey hunting, and I was really careful about ticks. And we did also did some mushroom hunting and actually found some morels, which was kind of cool. But I didn't come up with any ticks, but it almost feels like among my friends and acquaintances, everybody else has had a tick on them at one point or another yet already this spring.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the thing with ticks is that, especially with a species like deer tick, essentially if it's above freezing and there's no snow on the ground, they could be active. So if you're out wandering in the woods hunting for turkey or looking for morels and things like that, it is definitely something we need to be aware of and be doing tick checks and using repellents and the like. But with ticks themselves, it's rather interesting with the distributions we get. We know that they're fairly widely spread in the state, but I know of certain areas, even in Dane County, where you can go to a natural area on one side of the road and there's ticks, and you wander into the woods on the other side of the road and you can barely find them at all.
Isn't it? Why?
Who knows? That's a good question.
You haven't interviewed any to find out. Oh, my goodness me. Well, it's just, I suppose it's some combination, just exactly the right environment.
Yeah, it probably boils down to microclimate and also involved probably the mammal hosts, small rodents, chipmunks, mice,
sure.
Movement of deer, things like that are going to play a role as well.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Brian in Hayward has something for us. Hi, Brian.
Morning.
Morning. What's on your mind?
I've got a quick question about mosquitoes. I mean, it's getting that time of year.
Yeah.
And there is a Terminix product that I've been starting to see advertised that you spray on your foliage and mosquitoes will, I guess they feast on the bottom of your grassy areas. And they take up this substance, and it eradicates them. And I was wondering if anybody knows about this or where you could get it in a volume.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay, well, I'd have to see the particular ads to know the product that they're talking about in particular. My hunch, though, is that it may be some type of contact insecticide. And there's a group that we call the synthetic pyrethroids, which are very widely used. It contains ingredients such as permethrin, bifenthrin, and the like. And it's not unusual for these to be used in situations for mosquito control where an applicator will apply it to vegetation in a yard. And as you mentioned, if it gets sprayed onto the undersides of leaves and things like that, what happens is the mosquitoes often during the day, they rest in these locations, undersides of leaves, these kind of tucked away, shady, sheltered locations. And so if those plants have been treated and the mosquitoes land on it, they die in theory. So it's not so much applied to turf grass areas, but more of shrubby, wooded areas on the edges of yards, places like that. It can be successful in terms of killing off adult mosquitoes in your area, but there can be complications with this. It all depends on the mosquito species involved. We have some that stay fairly close to where they hatch out of the water. We have other mosquitoes that can blow or get or fly in from 5, 10, 20 miles down the road. And so in theory, you could have your yard treated today, kill an awful lot of mosquitoes. Next week, more could fly in from down the road, and you're just going to have mosquitoes around still. So it can be effective in certain cases, but the results tend to be somewhat short-lived.
Hmm. There we go. Thanks, Brian, for calling. You mentioned permethrin, and there is a product that you can spray on your clothes, which is a permethrin, and it supposedly will kill ticks. If a tick, for example, lands on your on your clothes, it'll kill that tick. And you wonder, number one, is it effective? But number two, what about the safety in terms of, you know, having something like that on your clothes?
Sure. Well, let's talk about the safety first. So a product like permethrin is from a group called the synthetic pyrethroids. These are chemical mimics of a natural plant extract from certain types of chrysanthemums. We call the natural extracts pyrethrins. Pyrethrins can kill insects and ticks, but they break down very quickly in sunlight. So what the chemists did, they modified the molecule a bit, made it a little bit longer lasting so that we can use it as clothing sprays and for other applications. Now, we actually use these same chemicals in human medicine. And in veterinary medicine, in some cases, if you were a human, you came down with head lice, for example, there are some louse shampoos that contain permethrin, and actually they're going to be in higher concentration than the stuff we're putting on our clothes for tick and mosquito prevention. And also, if you came down with something such as scabies, the physician was most likely prescribe a permethrin cream to apply directly onto your skin. So in terms of the safety issue, these are relatively non-toxic to humans, so very little risk there. In terms of their effectiveness, they can be very effective. They can be fairly long-lasting. Depending on the product, they may last through several clothing washes, cycles through the clothes washer. They will not only help repel ticks and mosquitoes, but they are an insecticide or acaricide. So if ticks are crawling on it, mosquitoes land on it, it can actually kill them as well.
So a pretty good product to have if you're going to be spending a lot of time out in the woods and you're not completely covering yourself, I guess.
Definitely, yeah. If you've got a certain set of pants or an outfit that you wear and you do a lot of yard work or you go hiking a lot, it can be worth it to pay the 10, 12 bucks to get a bottle of this, treat that particular set of clothing, and that'll give you very, very long-term and very effective results.
Gail in Madison up next. Gail, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a question about ant eradication. I have a patio that has a brick paved patio and an edge that's not easily removed, and it's hard to get bricks out. I have ants that are at least in their second season of pulling sand, et cetera, out from underneath the edges. And I feel like I'm noticing now a little bit of a cant to the bricks. And I'm wondering if there's a way that you eradicate those ants. The little containers and things I've gotten at the hardware store don't seem to be doing the job. So,
yeah,
sure. Well, my hunch in this case, we have a species of ant known as the pavement ant. And if you're ever walking down the sidewalk or looking at a brick patio and there's little mounds of dirt or sand piled up, it's often this species. Now, the thing when it comes to ant controls, if we can treat the nest directly with an insecticide and kill the queen, that gives us the best and the quickest results, frankly. In a case like this where we have highly compacted area with bricks, it might be hard to get an insecticide to soak into there.
Yeah.
So if there's any way to possibly look at where the ants are near amongst those bricks, if it's possible to pop out maybe a single brick, drench the soil beneath it and then put that brick back in, that would certainly be a way to take care of those ants fairly quickly.
There we go. Thanks for calling, Gail. Appreciate it. Helen in Dodgeville, it's your turn. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I'm calling about a tick that my son, he was visiting us. He is from the East Coast. He was visiting us a couple weeks ago, and he was out amongst some machinery that was in a place that was just full of weeds and people hadn't been around. And when he got home that night, he noticed he had a little tick. It was a little small one, but it was on the upper part of his leg. And he managed to get it off and put it in a little container. But, of course, it was red. It was quite red around it. And we watched it for a few days, and he put some antibiotic on it. But what I'm wondering is, how long is that a danger to him? Can it last for a while before something becomes worse, or would it...
So he got it off that right away? I mean, essentially within a few hours?
We think it was a few hours. We don't know for sure, but it was with that day, yes.
Within 24 hours?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so in a case like that, the risk or the chance of disease transmission really should be pretty low. For something like Lyme disease to be transmitted by deer ticks, the deer ticks typically have to be attached and feeding for at least 24 hours, but more realistically, 36 to about 48 hours. So a tick really has to be on you a long time before the odds of getting Lyme disease are really up there.
Well, we're guessing, of course, but when we told somebody about it, that person said, well, it was a tiny one, and we said, yeah, it was real tiny, and they said, well, the tiny ones are the most...
the deer ticks, yeah, often, yeah.
They're the worst, if they're real tiny, is that...
But that's the same, but still it's the same hours that you're talking about, isn't it, PJ?
Right, right, and in addition, another factor here, so with deer ticks, when deer ticks first hatch out of the egg, they don't have Lyme disease yet. They have to feed on a small mammal, such as a chipmunk or a mouse, that has Lyme disease to pick it up. One of the other juvenile stages might feed and potentially transmit it, but in terms of the percentage of ticks having Lyme disease, it's highest in the adults. But regardless, if that tick has only been attached a short period of time, the risk of transmitting something like Lyme disease are going to be pretty small.
Yeah.
Okay. So we are to consider quite surely, but if it should be longer in case he missed it before that, would it be a long time to watch it, or?
Yeah, there are, PJ, isn't there, I mean, if you were really worried about it, you can, there are some materials or shots that you can get.
Well, a couple of thoughts
here.
I guess first in this situation, if you still have the tick, you're always welcome to send it into my lab. We can just confirm the exact species of tick, because that can play a role in this. If it's something like a juvenile wood tick, you know, then we have much less of a concern. If it is a deer tick, and it sounds like it's been attached a short period of time, I would still generally monitor the situation and you know, maybe hold on to that tick in a Ziploc bag or something like that. If any symptoms pop up, achiness, just general feeling of unwell, I would certainly mention that to a physician and mention that there had been a tick bite and that you had it identified. And the physician can go from there in terms of potentially prescribing a short course dose of antibiotics, something along those lines.
There we go. Good luck, Helen. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. PJ Leash, our guest today, Extension and UW entomologist, director of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn finds out what it means to have the word healthy on a food label and how the FDA hopes to regulate it. That's at 2 o'clock today. Right now, we're taking a look at the world of insects here in the state with PJ Leash of the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. Join in with your questions. Open line will get you on fairly soon at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And if you have a photo, an insect photo, hey, post it up on our Facebook page. We'll take a look at it and comment on it. Jim in Colfax, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, PJ. So most of this, these questions get repeated from week to week, but I think I have one that I have and not the answer for. And it goes with kind of what the lady was talking about prior to this. I know that the 24-hour incubation with a deer tick, things like that, and that's transmitted. So I have a 4-year-old that has a head of hair like Goldilocks. It's curls and very thick. The other day she had a tick on her that she pulled off herself out of her hair, and it was swelled up with the blood such as you'd find on your dog, completely gray, expanded, solid filled. Well, I just did my duty and squashed it, and in the garbage it goes. Then my wife asked me, she says, well, can that transmit? And I says, well, I don't think so, because it's been sucking the blood for that. It was not buried in her skin, and or it was not a deer tick, but I have never seen a deer tick swell up, because I've never had one on my skin long enough, because I'm careful about it. So I guess the question is, how does a deer tick swell up compared to a normal wood tick, such as when I find them on my cat or dog and I just pop them off, squish them, and we're good, and you know, they pop the blood out. So, and then what happens to the tick after it swells up with blood? Is it like a mosquito where it goes to lay its eggs and then dies, or does it continue its life?
Okay.
Sure. So first and foremost, when deer ticks feed, especially the females, they do swell up quite substantially. And they will do that over a period of usually a couple of days. So they can really balloon up in size. And when they balloon up, it can really kind of distort their appearance, and it can make it a little hard to tell the exact tick species in some cases. So in a case like this, I would certainly keep an eye on your daughter, and if you notice any rash or anything like that, I would certainly mention to the physician that she did have a tick embedded or feeding on her for most likely a significant amount of time if it swelled up and had a lot of blood in it.
And is there a certain amount of time that you need to have a treatment to, let's say, well, if it's...
In general, the sooner you catch it, the better results we can get, or it's a little bit easier to take care of the problems. In places like Wisconsin, where we have an awful lot of deer ticks, and a lot of the ticks are carrying Lyme disease, and at the moment it's just over about 40% of the adult deer ticks are carrying Lyme disease in the state. One of the things the CDC has recommended is if you're bitten, the tick is attached for longer than about 24, 36 hours. That is a situation where transmission is more likely. A physician may prescribe a short-term dose of antibiotics to catch things when it's really kind of isolated in your body. If you were bitten by a tick and you didn't get treatment right away, then those bacteria can start spreading throughout your body and cause complications in heart and muscles and joints and things like that. So in general, the earlier...
Sooner is better.
Sooner is better, yeah.
Okay. All right. Jim, thanks again. And did we cover everything?
I think. How about the egg laying?
Egg laying.
Yes. Yeah, so what happens to ticks when they fall off? If it is a small, a juvenile tick, they are going to hop off the host after they've had their blood meal, and they are going to continue through their development. Now, if it's an adult tick like a female, as you mentioned, Jim, she is going to lay eggs. And this can be a process that takes several days. And a female that is fully engorged and has a full stomach of blood, she is going to be very slow and very lethargic, and she's not going to be able to move very far. It's kind of like Jabba the Hutt in Star Wars. But she is going to lay hundreds of eggs, and in a lot of cases, that may end up kind of being her end. It takes a lot of resources to produce all those eggs, and so it's not unusual for females to die in that egg-laying process.
Yeah, very interesting. Thanks, Jim, for calling. Appreciate it. Cheryl in Conover up next. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Last year I found, you know, and I'm kind of a mixed bag about homeopathic medicines and standard medicine because of my background. But I tried tea tree oil, one part tea tree oil and two parts water in a small little spray bottle you can pick up at your five and dime store. And I mean to tell you, that worked for ticks like you would not believe. And the way my husband and I even, and we have four dogs who are outside, and I put it on my feet when I walk out. We live in northern Wisconsin, and I put it around my shoes. Now, it's very pungent smelling, I will admit, but it works like a charm. And sometimes if you just gently spray it on the dog's paws, you don't even get them lighting on the paws. And the way we kind of tested this to see if it would work, we have a shed, and of course it was spring, and the ticks were crawling up the shed. So I grabbed the spray and sprayed them, and they went down instantly. It was faster than DEET.
So you had tea tree oil, lemon, and water.
Well, I just use tea tree oil and water.
Oh, tea tree oil.
One part tea tree oil to two parts water in a little spray jar, and you kind of shake it before you spray it on. And then for mosquitoes, I tried this one. It's lavender, like 10 drops of lavender, a quarter teaspoon of lemon juice, and water, and that works for mosquitoes. And I'm very Scandinavian, so the mosquitoes just love feasting on me. And it really helped. And the mosquito repellent smelled better than the tick repellent.
All right, there you go. Well, Cheryl, thanks for calling. PJ?
Well, so there is some truth behind some of these essential oils. Some of them are known to have repellent properties. And in some cases, essential oils can actually be toxic to insects. So if you were to spray them directly, it doesn't surprise me all that much that they die. Now, if you dig into the scientific literature, we know that these products do have some effectiveness. The problem is they typically don't hold up or seem to be effective for very long. However, if you look at some of these products, they have been screened farther and do show some pretty good results. And in particular, there are insect repellents for mosquitoes and ticks that contain an oil of lemon eucalyptus. And if you go on the internet and you search for EPA and approved repellents, there's really about 3-4 repellents that the EPA has really had a lot of research on. Things like DEET and picaridin are kind of our gold standards that most folks are aware of. But this oil of lemon eucalyptus is one that does seem to work pretty well.
Cheryl, thanks again for calling. I appreciate it very much. And I want to give Rich and Madison a chance to join us next. Rich, hello.
Love the show. I love public radio, I tell you. But hi. The oil of eucalyptus, just to add, I've used that, and that's tremendous, absolutely tremendous. It doesn't last as long as the DEET, but, boy, is it ever good. But I had a question, kind of a follow-up to your previous caller. And, are there any soaps or anything that a person would use that, you know, we spend a lot of time out and, you know, walking through the woods and hiking and stuff like that, and with children, I was just thinking, is there some sort of soap, very much like she said, she sprayed that stuff and they fall off, in case you don't catch a tick that would be good to use.
Okay.
And I'll take my answer off here.
All right. Thanks, Rich.
Sure. So the soap does bring up an interesting topic. There are actually soaps designed specifically for use as insecticides. I mean, you can go to the garden center and find these. Now, those are intended more for use on plants, house plants, garden plants, and the like. And these insecticidal soaps are really chemically very similar or fairly similar to things like Dawn dish soap, except the dish soap will have colors and fragrances and moisturizers, things like that. And how these soaps work is they can do a little bit of two things. First of all, insects breathe through tiny openings on the side of their body that lead to air ducts. And the soap may interfere and disrupt breathing to a certain extent. But more importantly, these soaps can kind of diffuse through the bodies of soft-bodied insects, and it just starts wreaking all kinds of havoc inside the body. It basically starts dissolving some of the cell membranes. And so there is some truth to that insects can be used for, or soaps can be used for insecticidal purposes. Now, when it comes to things like ticks or things like chiggers, perhaps, a general suggestion, if you've been spending a lot of time outdoors, as soon as you come in, if you take a kind of a warm soapy bath or warm soapy shower, that may help remove some of those additional critters that you might have missed in a tick check. And in addition, the soap may help kill some of them in the act.
Kathy and Madison up next with a question. Hi, Kathy.
One in five. Who evidently react.
You're breaking up, Kathy, but I think I know what you're talking about. Kathy is someone who apparently has a bad reaction to sand fleas and, you know, wondering where do they live and, you know, is there something you can do to kind of repel them?
Well, I guess when I think of sand fleas, I think more of an insect-like critter that is down in places like Florida.
Yeah.
So I'm not really familiar with any of them being around here. There could be some other creature that may have a different local name up here, but in terms of sand fleas, I'm thinking of something that lives more down south that we wouldn't bump into in Wisconsin.
Okay. And if she travels, I guess, to the south, is there anything that you know about the sand fleas that would be useful? And, you know, if you're down, I remember them from Nicaragua, some work in Nicaragua, and I had sand fleas, and they were awful.
Mm-hmm. I would expect in a situation like that, if you were in a spot where you just happen to be bumping into a lot of them, I mean, removing yourself from that type of situation, I would also suspect that warm soap and water may also help in some of those cases if you had them on you.
Yeah, and if you're allergic to them, she is apparently allergic to them, so she's important for her to have some sort of repellent.
Well, and in a case like that with allergies, everyone can react a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. And so in some folks, they can get bitten by mosquitoes or something else, and they might even need to take some type of antihistamine, whereas other people might not react at all.
Talking today with P.J. Leash from the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, taking a look at the world of insects here in Wisconsin. Join in with your own questions at 1-800-642-1234. And we have open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question and or photo on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. We have Steve in Superior up next. Steve, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, you bet. I do a lot of trail running and hiking out in the woods.
Yeah.
And I've discovered a couple of pretty good non-repellent things that work for ticks. What I do if I'm out running and if I've got shorts on, what I do is I take petroleum jelly and just put it on pretty thick, right above my sock, and because almost all the ticks come up out of the grass. So what happens is the ticks will get stuck in the jelly, and they aren't able to dig into your skin through that jelly. They more or less just get stuck there.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I've used, if I'm not wearing shorts, you can take an old pair of socks. Say just you can put like your regular pair of socks on, and then take an older pair of second socks, and on your socks you can just rub a bunch of just general purpose grease, like wheel bearing grease or something. Mm-hmm. And that essentially does the same thing as the jelly, but you don't want to put that on your skin. You know, you'd want to use that on your clothes. And if you put that on your clothes, put it on something old you don't care about, like I said, like an old pair of socks or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that works really good for ticks. Another suggestion I was going to make about another pest are deer flies, which can be pretty bad, especially up here.
Miserable.
In the thick woods. And those things, you know, they mostly bother you around your back of your head and your neck. And I've came up with a product that it's kind of like a thing you fold out, like a little bandana, and it's got a real sticky compound on the back of it that you pin to your hat and then tie it around you. And that works really well for stopping deer flies. And I'm actually going to start selling the thing out on the internet. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to launch a website. It's called deerflystopper.com. Mm. And I'm going to sell them for $3 a piece. And that works really well for deer flies. So just a couple suggestions there.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Deer flies are miserable.
They can be. And if you are out in the woods, deer flies can, you know, make fishing miserable or make other activities like trail running miserable as well. And it's interesting, the caller's kind of device that he invented with a kind of a sticky coating on it. I've heard of other folks doing that too. And the basis for this, it turns out that deer flies and horse flies, they usually feed on large mammals, livestock, deer, humans, and things like that. But over evolutionary time and for whatever reason, they have become adapted to kind of seek out dark-colored moving objects that is, you know, an animal to feed on or something like that. I know from my own experience when my wife and I hike in the North Woods, we have two black labs. And so all the deer flies follow the dogs through the woods and we're left alone for the most part. And so I've heard of folks when they go out mowing the lawn, putting a sticky-coated hat on, and all the deer flies will be attracted to that, and then they don't get as many bites. So there is definitely some truth to that you could use sticky cards to take care of some of the deer fly problems.
And it does make sense to use some salve or petroleum jelly around your ankle if you're going to run and be outside, if you're not going to have pants
Yeah, I mean, that certainly could be an option. Otherwise, if you use the repellents like DEET or Picaridin or other EPA-approved one, or even that permethrin treatment, you could potentially put that on your pair of running shoes or pair of socks that you use regularly.
Sarah in Caledonia, Minnesota, up next. Hi, Sarah. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I've just been listening to your program, and I wanted to share with you guys. I found this amazing bug spray. Actually, my friend gave me a sample of it. It's called the Zach and Nax bug spray. I was checking them out on their website, zachandnax.com, and oh my gosh, it's amazing. It's made from 4 essential oils and then soybean oil, so it works a terrific against the mosquitoes and ticks. And then even those pesky flies. I mean, I couldn't believe how well it works. And there's no citronella, so it doesn't stink. But yeah, I use it on my dog and my daughter, on me, and it's just an amazing product. I can't believe how effective it is. And I wanted to share with you guys. It's definitely something worth checking out.
All right. What's the call again?
Zach and Nax Bug Spray. And they have the website is zachandnax.com. There's actually a few really interesting videos they have on demonstrating with ticks, and it really is. It's really something that I think I'll probably use for the rest of my life.
Sarah, thanks. Appreciate the call. Are you familiar with that product?
So I have not heard of that one before. I'll definitely have to check out that website. As we kind of discussed with some earlier callers, there is some evidence that some of these essential oils can have repellent properties against mosquitoes, ticks, maybe certain other flies. In general, they tend to be fairly short-lived, but folks are developing new kind of formulations all the while. But we just have to look at the scientific data and see how things would shake out that way.
Let's turn next to Todd in Madison. Todd, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I got a couple of ways to keep bugs off you without any chemicals. I fly fish, and one thing that works really well, especially for deer fly, if they're biting you, if you have an old hat that you wear fishing, take a piece of fly paper and use it, make a headband out of it around your hat, the sticky side out, and it'll catch the deer fly and such. It works really well, especially fishing up north. That really, it's kept me on the water once where other guys were getting driven off. And one thing, an old farmer around Fenimore, I was out fishing once, and those little teeny flies, you know, that fly in your eyes, and they get all over the cattle's face.
Yeah.
Vanilla. An old farmer told me that, and it works. You take a bandana and just put some pure vanilla on it, and it keeps them off. He said he would rub it on his cow's faces, and it really works.
Ah, very interesting. Vanilla.
Yeah, so I actually have heard of some research using vanilla either as a standalone product or being incorporated into another type of repellent, and some of the data shows that it might help increase repellent properties in some cases, so there is some truth behind that.
Oh, interesting. Thanks, Todd. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
We have more callers. Let's go to James in Janesville next. Thanks, James, for calling.
Yeah, my name is James, and I'm from Janesville. And I was wondering, somehow I contracted, I believe they're mites. And what they do is when they bite you, they leave like a perforated line. And they're just so tiny you can't hardly see them. And I tried spraying and all that, and nothing.
Hmm. Yeah,
they still come back. They seem to die off a little bit, then they come back.
Okay.
All right.
Well, interesting. We do actually get a few types of mites that can potentially bite people, especially this time of the year. There is a creature out there called a bird mite, which is a parasite of birds. We do bump into these occasion where someone has a bird nest either right outside a bedroom window, underneath a back porch, on top of a deck or patio light, something like that. And if the bird nest is right on the side of the house, the bird mites can wander in. In theory, they can bite people. They're just big enough you can see them with your naked eye. They look like walking grains of pepper against a light-colored surface. With something like bird mites, the solution is really to remove or relocate the bird nest, because those mites, while they can bite people, they really prefer to be on their bird host. So that's certainly one possibility. There's lots of different mites out there. It's really hard to tell. I'd almost have to see a specimen under the microscope to tell you exactly what it is. If you can find some, you're welcome to send it into the diagnostic lab and I could take a peek. Once you know for sure what it is, then we'll have a better idea of what to do about it next.
There we go. Thanks very much for calling. PJ Leash, our guest today from the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network as we take a look at the world of insects with PJ Leash, who is with the heads the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Join in at 800-642-1234. If you got a photo, send it to our Facebook page, Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And speaking of photos, my old friend Kurt Westbrook sent a photo on our Facebook page. And Kurt's wondering about this particular moth. I was trying to find it in the, you know, his bug book, but he couldn't find out what he thought what it was.
Yeah, so this species, it's a looks like a pretty good size moth that is almost entirely whitish, but it's got some black kind
pretty.
Of ring spots. Yeah, it is a very, very pretty moth. It's one of our tiger moths that we happen to call a leopard moth because of the spotted pattern on the wings. Not terribly common, but we do have them here. The caterpillars will feed on a variety of plants out in the woods or in yards, but definitely one of our neat moths. And if you think of moths and butterflies, and a lot of species are starting to become active this time of the year, we've got about 150 or so species of butterflies in the state. We've probably got about 4,000 species of moths. So there's
wow.
an amazing diversity on there. There are polka-dotted moths, striped moths, all kinds of neat moths out there if you take the time to take a closer look at them.
Yeah, that's a very cool photo. We have, thanks, Kurt, for sending that. David and Slinger up next. Hi, David.
Hi. Two things, a comment and then a question. There are, in my mind, there's good bugs and bad bugs. The bad ones are the invasive species kinds of things. I'll come across larvae or bugs. Is there a website that can help you identify? So I don't want to be killing the good guys. I do want to get rid of the bad guys that are eating our trees and that sort of thing.
Sure. So a couple thoughts along this line. Probably the best website out there that I use very regularly for my work, it's called bugguide.net. And these are images submitted by volunteers or the general public. They do get identified, so you know that it's a reliable identification. We know exactly what the creature is. So lots of images on that site. The downside to it is such a big and such an exhaustive website that you can very easily get lost for hours. And there's a lot of insects that look very similar. Yeah, and it can be, you can spend hours just looking at that site and kind of getting lost. It is rather fun, though. On my website at the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, I do have a second site that I host, which focuses on insect identification. And I've got pictures, and you can browse through about 200, 250 different insects that are more common to Wisconsin. So that's another good site that you can use. Otherwise, you had mentioned trying to tell apart good bugs and bad bugs in your yard. There is a really good book out there called Garden Insects of North America by Whitney Cranshaw. And you can find it at places like Barnes & Noble for about $25-$30 or so. And that talks a lot about all the pests in the landscape, but also beneficial good bugs as well. And so that's probably one of my favorite print resources for identifying things.
It's another book that I don't know if you've seen it, but I interviewed the author once, and it came to mind immediately when David mentioned I'm looking for good bug and bad bug, because that's the title of the book, mm-hmm. Good Bugs and Bad Bugs. So uh-huh. it's a combination of book. I think it was the author might have been Minnesota, but anyway, the insects issues would be very similar.
Sure. And if you think about all the insects in the state, we've got 20 to 25,000 different insect species in Wisconsin alone. It's tough to know all of them and tell is this a good one or is a bad book. So books like that really can help you out.
Yep, absolutely.
But the other question I had was about 15 years ago, I was hiking along the southern shore of Superior, and I was attacked. Apparently there was a hatch of bugs about the size of a bean, a small bean, and they bit like crazy. I mean, they could bite through cloth. People were leaving campsites. I was completely covered, literally, from head to toe. I couldn't see my clothes. Do you have any idea? It was a bug that was introduced, apparently, to try to get rid of something else.
No.
Well, so a couple of thoughts. We do have some parasitic flies that have either been introduced or are natives that will help kill off certain caterpillars up north, but those flies really don't bite people. A thought, though, because you mentioned you were along the southern shore of Lake Superior, at certain times of the year, there is a fly species called the stable fly, and it gets that name because it also hangs out on farms, and it bites typically the legs of livestock, cattle and the like, and that can cause major problems for folks trying to raise livestock. But those flies bite like the dickens. They look almost like a house fly, but they have a very long, piercing mouth part, and they bite and it hurts. So you really want to get up, and it wouldn't surprise me if you had a lot of those that folks might abandon their campsites.
Mm. Yeah, they bit through my shirt, and my arms were numb for about a week just from all the bites.
So. Oh, boy.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, David. Kate in Green Bay up next. Kate, hello. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I have had experience with bed bugs this year, and we got rid of our bed and everything to do with it, and we were sleeping on our pull-out couch, and I all of a sudden got bites that looked like bed bug bites, but I knew they weren't. And my boyfriend said that they were probably spider bites, and I'm wondering if that's a possibility.
Not likely, but I don't think either.
Yeah, not likely. It turns out that spiders really don't go out of their way to bite people. Spider bites do occur on occasion. It's more likely in a situation where someone maybe has a spider hanging out in a gardening glove. You go out to your garage, you put the glove on, and defensively the spider bites because it's starting to get squished. But in terms of spiders just walking around and biting people, if you study their behavior, that type of thing really just doesn't seem to happen.
Okay.
Now, when it comes to bed bugs, did you call in a pest control company to spray or heat treat for the bed bugs?
We use stuff from Walmart, the powder, spray, traps, everything that we could find. And then once we disposed of the mattress and the bed frame and everything else to deal with it, we rug doctored the entire room.
Okay. I mean, when it comes to dealing with bed bugs, being thorough is really one of the most important things. Typically, though, if I have someone contact me in the diagnostic lab and I confirm it as bed bugs, I usually direct them towards a pest control professional, simply because bed bugs are notoriously difficult to get rid of. Even if you buy different products and use different methods, they can hide in places such as wall voids. They can basically sneak through the electrical outlet cover plates and things like that. And so you can be very, very thorough and get 98% of them. But those 2% over time could kind of repopulate a situation. Even if you've thrown out your bed and frame and things like that, they could potentially find you sleeping on a pull-out couch. So because of the history of bed bugs, I would still be a little suspicious that they may still be around.
Okay.
So what would be your advice in that situation then?
But in a case like that, it may still be useful to call a pest control company, especially one that deals with bed bugs. And a lot of companies do these days. The bigger companies will have crews kind of designated just to dealing with bed bugs alone because it's such a big and hot topic. The companies can do a couple of things. They can do some very thorough additional inspections to see if there are any additional signs of bed bugs around. In some cases, if you really want to know definitively are there bed bugs or not, there are trained canines, bed bug detection dogs that are trained to, and they can actually differentiate between live and dead bed bugs. So if you really want to know, You call up one of these companies, you have them come in, and very, very quickly they can tell you, do you have live bed bugs or not?
Oh, wow. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, they're devils to get rid of once you've got them.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting with bed bugs because after World War II, with things like DDT, bed bugs almost went extinct. We just didn't have many of them around. But due to issues with resistance to certain insecticides, they've really come roaring back in about the last 15 to 20 years and are essentially countrywide at this point.
Oh, man. Well, you may have a question for us. PJ Leash, our guest today, who is heading up the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW-Madison. Question about a bug that might be in your house or maybe a one that's on your plants, give us a call. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. So give us a call, shoot us an email. We had box elder bugs as a question from Max on Facebook. They aren't a problem right now, Max says, but they certainly will be in September as they again invade our home and we have to deal with them all fall, winter, and spring inside our house. And there are a real problem, and Max is wondering what to do about it. What can they do to cut down the number? And is our wood mulch in our flower beds a problem? Does that harbor those insects? And if so, you know, what the heck can we do about all this? And you know what? Here we are. We'll ponder that question because we need to take a quick look at the news and weather. And then we'll be back with PJ Leash and we'll address that problem. And yours too. Stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, taking a look at the world of insects here in the state and in the Midwest with our guest, PJ Leash, who heads up the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison. Questions? We have one open line at 1-800-642-1234. You can also shoot us an insect photo on our Facebook page, our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show, and email us at talk@wpr.org. And now here I've already forgotten the question that we had just at oh, I know, it had to do with I've lost my train of thought on that. It was a bug, and it was
box elder bug.
Box elder bug. You're exactly right.
Yeah. So in that question on Facebook, the mulch component, first off, that shouldn't be an issue. Box elder bugs, what they're doing, they feed on the seeds of box elder trees. And if you think of box elders, they're technically a type of maple. So box elder bugs can also feed on seeds of things like silver maple and maybe a few of the other types of maples. They're really not associated much with mulch. You might see them walking on mulch, but they're probably not using it as a sheltering spot. And in general, if you've got very heavy mulch beds right against your house, that could potentially harbor some other things like slugs and earwigs and things like that if it holds in a lot of moisture. Now, the most important things when it comes to box elder bugs, in terms of controlling them, the best ideal long-term solution, if you look on the outside of your house for cracks and crevices where these guys are sneaking in late summer and in the fall, if we can physically seal those openings up with caulk or expanding insulation foam, that will physically keep them outside. Now, in some homes, if you've got an older or, you know, a wood siding home, that might just be tough to do. So we can go out in late summer, usually by about the beginning of September, spray the exterior of our home with one of these synthetic pyrethroid insecticides. And you can hire a pest control company to do this, but something like permethrin or bifenthrin. And those products stick right where you've applied them, so to the side of your home, siding, foundation. And if insects like box elder bugs or Asian lady beetles walk across or contact those substances, it either irritates them and they leave or it kills them outright. So that's one approach we can use. In terms of what the box elder bugs are going to do this year, I'm sure some listeners are wondering. It's a little hard to tell at this point. With box elder bugs, they are dependent somewhat on the weather, and they thrive under very hot, dry conditions. So if we had a year like 2012 with that drought, box elder bugs would love it. If we have a rainy year, there is actually a fungal disease that pops up and kills off a lot of them and keeps their numbers lower. So it'll all depend a bit on the rainfall we get this year. But again, sealing things up or spraying the outside of our house can certainly help prevent box elder bug problems indoors.
And especially the sunny side?
Yeah, pay most attention to the south-facing side of the house and also the west-facing side of the house. Because as you just alluded to, Larry, those are the spots that get the afternoon sun. They tend to be warmer, and so you often get box elder bugs congregating there.
Right there, yeah. Ruth in Mineral Point, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, it's another tick question.
Okay.
Zika's not around here. I'm not too worried about that. But what about chronic wasting disease, which is around here? The DNR has reported an increase. And most of the people I know who hunt don't get their deer tested. So I would guess that maybe it's more prevalent than the reports suggest. And the question is really, which ticks carry that?
So as far as I know, I'm not aware of any ticks that carry chronic wasting disease. My understanding is that that is a protein-like disease that is transmitted. Deer pick it up when they're feeding on plants that have it on them and things like that. But it's not an insect.
Touching noses, things
exactly,
like that.
Exactly, animal-to-animal contact. But that's not a tick or mosquito-borne disease.
Uh-huh.
So you're safe that way anyway. Thanks, Ruth, for calling. Sally in Middleton, what's on your mind?
Oh, a lot. I've got a real plague here. Never had it until this spring. Now I lived here 22 years and didn't ever see anything at all. And then all of a sudden, here came these moths. And they of course, like light. And I'm in the kitchen, so at night they're flying around the kitchen light. And they don't seem to be all that attracted to food, except that they're in the kitchen and not in the living room. So it must be something about the kitchen that has them, plus the fact that I have the light on every night. But where on earth are they coming from? Why are they in here? And how do I get rid of them?
That's a good question, and it may be food-related.
Yeah, that would be my hunch. Now, what we could do in this case, if you can catch one of the moths or snap some pictures of them and get that to me, I can confirm the exact species. My suspicion, though, is that it's probably a species called the Indian meal moth, which is probably our most common moth that we get indoors and especially around the pantry or kitchen area. And as Larry just mentioned, these insects are associated with food items. And it's usually not food that's being used up quickly. It's a box of baking mix or flour or some other item, crackers, that has been in the pantry for a very long time, months or longer.
We had had it in our house. This is years ago. We had my friend had a dog, and we had some dog food, dry dog food. And that was the source of the problem.
Yeah. Exactly. So in a case like this, this Indian meal moth can feed on things like pet food. It can basically feed on any flour, grain-based items, other plant material like bulk spices, dried teas, things like that. If you have bulk nuts, that's one place I often find them. At the time of the holidays, you buy walnuts and pecans and things like that. Another place they often show up is bird seed. So in a case like this, what often gets rid of them is doing some detective work, finding which item or items are infested and either throwing those out, or if it were something like pet food and the dog or cat might not care, you could take that infested item, throw it in the freezer for a couple days. That would kill them. If you do find items, or just in general, that are free of infestation, put them in some type of tightly sealing container with the lid, Tupperware or something like that. That will prevent moths from getting in the future and kind of continuing this infestation.
So do a little detective work, Sally, and I think you're going to be, you'll be successful once you find that source, because the source is gone, so are the mosquitoes or the moths.
Exactly.
I learned that lesson back those many years back. Thanks again. Jan and Mosini, it's your turn. Hi, Jan. Thank you for calling.
Yes, a good, beautiful afternoon to you. A question about a bed bug. How does a person contact them? Is it just from staying like in a motel or a resort, or do you stay at someone's house that may have them and they jump on to your clothes? I'd just be curious to know how a person would ever get bed bugs.
Yeah, so schools a lot of times. I'm sure they get transferred that, or I would bet. Anyway, BJ, that would be an area.
Yeah, well, it can happen at schools. Not very often, though.
Oh.
The main ways that bed bugs are transmitted, and these aren't insects that jump onto people or really hang out on people, it tends to do more with the movement of personal items. So if you or I go to a hotel, we're on vacation or visiting someone, and the hotel room happens to be infested and we put our suitcase down, if the bed bugs are out feeding during the night, when the sun starts coming up, they like to hide, so they might sneak into your suitcase, then you bring them home. Same exact thing if you're staying at someone's home and they have a bed bug infestation. These insects could sneak into your suitcase, a backpack, but it's typically items like that that the insects get into, and then we as humans bring those items back to our own home, and then the bed bugs sneak out from there and create a local population.
Is there do you have advice in terms of, let's say you're going to a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
How do you kind of protect that from happening?
Sure. One of the best things to do is just do a general quick inspection. When you get into the hotel room, what I would do is either leave my suitcase in the car until after I've done inspection, or bring it into the hotel room and put it in a place like the bathroom counter, the bathtub, a location that's bright, sunny, open. Bed bugs don't like those types of places. Then I would inspect the bed, mattress, box spring, frame, nearby pieces of furniture like a nightstand, especially the back of the nightstand, back of headboards. These are places that bed bugs like to hang out. If you find any of the insects, or you just get kind of a weird feeling that there's maybe dark black marks, which are from the bed bug excrement, that tells you there might be bed bugs, you know, that those are certainly red flags. Go down and talk to the desk. But one of the worst things you could do is walk into the hotel room, throw your suitcase on the bed, and then go out for dinner and drinks and come back a few hours later, because there's a chance bed bugs got into your stuff.
Oh.
Okay, that's the question I was just going to ask. Thank you, Larry.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jan, for calling. Appreciate it. And John in Galena, Illinois, up next. Hi, John.
How's it going?
Great. Appreciate your call.
For taking my call.
You bet.
I've got a few acres of prairie, which I tend to remediate the tech problem with burns and free-range chickens. But I'm planning on putting a wetlands in the corner, and I was just wondering about, am I encouraging mosquitoes to show up, and is there anything I could introduce into the wetlands that might either feed on the mosquito larvae, or am I just kind of bringing mosquitoes in?
Sure. Well, there is certainly a possibility that if you have a plot of land without water and we're introducing a watery wetland area, that could be potential mosquito breeding habitat. Now, in general, mosquitoes don't like to breed in fast or moving water. They prefer more of stagnant bodies of water, especially ones with lots of vegetation in it. So if you have a lot of plants and we're getting leaves and materials like that falling into the water, those are types of areas that mosquitoes seem to like and seek out, and the females of certain species will lay eggs in those cases. So it certainly is possible that by introducing this body of water, you could have some mosquitoes show up. Now, in terms of things we could introduce, something that's great at feeding at mosquitoes, things like dragonflies. We can't really, you know, buy dragonfly larvae on the internet to introduce. It's possible over time dragonflies of certain species could show up on their own. One possibility, there are cases where folks have used certain top feeding minnows to control mosquito larvae. So you put the minnows of certain fish species in there, and they feed on the mosquito larvae and pupae that are hanging out in the water.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, John. Appreciate it. And Bob in Stevens Point, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to add a comment to your guest speakers with insects around the home. I found that I'm starting to do it myself in clients' homes, that installing a barrier of about 30 to 36 inches wide of a stone aggregate around the entire home, the perimeter, and it's easier to maintain things around there and put your plantings outside of that. And I don't think you'd have a problem then with insects, and people have a concern with that way with using organic mulches.
Yeah, that could be a big help, couldn't it, PJ?
Oh, certainly, yeah, and that is really a great point. In general, I know my predecessor, Phil Pelletieri, would joke about this, but if you make your yard a sandbox,
yeah,
you know, all kinds of insects just are not going to do well in those types of habitat. It's too open, too sunny, too dry. And so if we have a gap between our home and any vegetation, you know, hostas or something like that, and we have rocks or other material in there, that's going to help decrease insect activity in that area, which means that's going to lower our chances of creatures sneaking into our home. So it, even
and also it's easier to maintain around your home. You've got to wash windows and things like that, you know, so you got to kind of got more than one bang for your buck, so to speak.
Yeah,
good point.
Even a gap of, you know, maybe a foot or so will help, but as you just mentioned, Bob, if we've got, you know, 3 feet, that does make it easier to do maintenance things around the house,
absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Bob.
You're welcome.
Yeah, appreciate the call. We have a question from Jennifer on Facebook who says, in southeastern Wisconsin, what are the bugs that bite mostly around the ankles in grass or woody areas? They don't seem to be visible, but they cause a lot of bites. They seem like mosquito bites, but they last a lot longer. And we have much more intense itch after the fact. Are they chiggers or what?
Yeah, so my thought in this case, these are probably chiggers. And chiggers are the juvenile stage of a certain type of mite. We call the adults from that family velvet mites. But the juveniles are blood feeders in some cases, and they'll go to other animals out in the environment. But occasionally, if we as humans wander through their habitat, they can latch on and they will bite us. Now, by the time that you notice the itching, the mites are already gone in most cases. Typically what they do, they feed and they actually inject a chemical substance that liquefies your tissue a bit so that they can drink it up. But overall, people aren't a very good host for them. So they bite, they end up leaving, and then we get this intense irritation later on. Repellents can help a little bit with them. Otherwise, a local antihistamine applied to the skin may help with the local reaction. Or if you know you've been in a spot where you just know from previous experience there's chiggers there, as soon as you get home, warm soapy water, warm bath, that can often help in a lot of cases.
There we go. And Barbara sent us something about some research. She wondered if you knew anything about a kite, I think it is, which is a research lab in California, which is working on a natural mosquito repellent that's used as a little patch. Said to be very effective. Last year, the New York Times did a piece on it, extensive piece demonstrating, the writer demonstrated putting her arm in a tank of mosquitoes with no repellent and another with the repellent, and with the repellent, no mosquito bites.
So I do recall seeing that New York Times article about these little patches used for mosquito repellents. Unfortunately, I don't recall the details of that article in terms of what was contained in the patches. I know there is a lot of interesting research being done at the moment in terms of repellents. And one particular area of research people are looking at is the natural chemistry of human skin. And so if you think of humans, we sweat and we secrete other chemicals onto our skin, and then there are bacteria and other microorganisms that break down these chemicals. So if you think about it, we're essentially covered in this chemical soup, and that can have effects on either attracting or in some cases repelling mosquitoes. And so I almost wonder if some of those patches might be using research kind of along those lines.
Ah, very interesting. You know, last time you were here, we talked about the storm in Mexico that threatened the monarch butterfly population. You probably remember that. Have you
yeah.
heard any more about the effects of that storm?
Yeah, so back in March, and we've got all the monarch butterflies hanging out very densely clustered in a mountainous region in Mexico, and the jet stream dipped way down low. And at the time, I think we were in about the 60s or so. Well, down in Mexico, it was snowing on these monarchs. And there is a chance in the monarchs, it's really kind of a strategy of all the eggs in one basket because they're all huddled together. If it's cold enough, they can die. And several years back, this happened. A massive storm killed off, you know, 60, 70, 80% of the monarchs in some locations. The good news is that folks, researchers down there, went out a few days later and they noticed the monarchs were still clinging to the trees, which is a good sign. If the monarchs die outright from a frost, they tend to fall off the trees. So that was certainly a little bit of encouraging news. I was checking a website yesterday. There's a great website called WisconsinButterflies.org, I believe it is, or .net, one of those two, of sightings in the state. And I have not seen or heard of any monarch reports in Wisconsin yet, but it wouldn't surprise me if in the next week or two we started getting some reports. So at the moment, my monarch outlook is optimistic because we did have a larger overwintering population this year. Sounds like they probably weathered that winter storm, and so I've got my fingers crossed for it.
Excellent. Rick in Madison, hi.
Hi there. This is a tick question. If you're roaming around in the grasses and brush, can you spray bug spray down where your cuffs would be on the bottom of your pants as enough of a repellent to feel a little bit safe about that?
Well, I would probably go a little bit higher than that. If you're out hiking around this time of the year, and I've run into this myself on many occasions, you're in a park with a mowed path and the tall grass along the edge of the trail, you'll actually see ticks hanging out on those weedy grasses just waiting for a human, a dog, a deer to walk by. And so that might be at about knee level or so. So if you just spray your ankle area, that might not offer complete protection. If you did from about the knee on down, that should probably have you pretty well covered.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Other pollinators, what are the how are we doing on some of our pollinators right now? There's a lot of threats out there.
Yeah, so a lot of things going on with pollinators between pesticide use, habitat destruction, just in terms of not as much green space around today compared to 50 or 100 years ago. I know there's a big push and movement at the moment for folks to be planting bee and butterfly gardens. You can actually build or buy your own bee hotels that native bees can do. In the state, there recently was a pollinator protection plan that came out that gives a lot of good suggestions for what folks can do to protect pollinators. And it could be farmers. It could be you or I doing gardening in our backyards. There's a lot of good information coming out. I think the public awareness is definitely up. And so overall, I'm fairly optimistic at this point. I've been getting a lot of reports just this spring alone of folks noticing bees out in local parks and places like that. So I think because of the awareness, I certainly am in an optimistic mood at this point.
Wonderful. Mark wondered if you've heard about a plan to reintroduce lake flies to Lake Butamore and Poygan and Winneconne. Hard to imagine.
So I haven't heard of any plans to reintroduce them. I haven't heard of them going extinct either.
I don't think they've gone away.
Yeah, their populations can vary from year to year. But if the conditions are right, we can get some very, very large emergences of these lake flies. It's actually a small mosquito-like fly called a midge. They don't bite, but they look somewhat similar to mosquitoes. And in some cases, you can get large clouds where it looks like smoke from miles away. But I haven't heard of them disappearing. They're still around. But as I mentioned, their numbers can fluctuate from year to year quite a bit.
Well, PJ, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much. It's been great talking to you and we answered a heck of a lot of questions.
Yeah, pleasure to be here today.
We'll get you back and we'll do this again. Thank you again. Patrick Leash, PJ Leash, with degrees in biological sciences and entomology from UW-Madison, manages the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he's a UW Extension guy as well. So great to have him along, and he will be back, and we'll talk with him again. Just to take a look ahead, if you're thinking about summer travel, we'll be talking about that tomorrow. We'll get some travel information from our travel expert, and we'll talk about great Wisconsin wetland areas that you can visit. So that should be a lot of fun. And in the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's usually not one thing,
It's several things. Back to back to back that leave you in a place you never expected to be. On the next Snap Judgment, To the Brink. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Tonight at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio.